Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How are your most or least favorite issues faring in the Missouri legislature? Well, we'll take a look as the session nears the halfway point in just a couple of moments. But first, genetic sequencing has given modern medicine an inside look at how our bodies work or don't work. While it provides answers and insight into health and disease, it also raises many questions relating to ethics and privacy. St. Louis Public Radio science reporter Veronique LaCapra recently talked with two physicians, both academics, who come at the tough issues from divergent angles. Laura Jean Byrud is professor of psychiatry at Washington University. Lainey Friedman Ross is clinical medical ethics professor at the University of Chicago. Veronique began by asking Dr. Ross to define whole genome sequencing.
Whole genome sequencing is when you're looking actually at all the genes that make up a person. So it turns out many of us know that we have 46 chromosomes, but there are 20-plus thousand genes on those chromosomes, and there's about 3 billion base pairs that make up the whole genome. And so when we're looking at both the genes as well as the material between the genes.
All right, and why is it usually done?
And it's usually done in my field in pediatrics, for example, if we have a child for whom we don't have a diagnosis by any of the traditional means that we can use. So we've looked diagnostically, with x-rays, with blood tests, and so this is one way, and one of the more common reasons, at least at this point, is for intellectual disability, although it's an ever-evolving field, and there will be many more uses in the future.
Laura, would you agree with that? Anything to add to that?
Absolutely, I agree. The children, it's really with children with congenital syndromes where the whole genome sequencing is entering the field.
And I know that one of the issues that comes up with whole genome sequencing is what's called incidental findings. Can you explain what that means, Laura?
Incidental findings are where you identify another finding that was not the primary reason that you were looking in the whole genome. So if you're looking for an issue with developmental disability or a congenital syndrome, you might find something else in the person's genome. You may find that they are at risk for breast cancer, at risk for colon cancer, at risk for a variety of other diseases. And so there's this issue about what do we do with these incidental findings? Do we return these to the patients?
Meaning, do we tell the patients
yes,
about them?
Or not.
And what's your answer?
So there's a lot of gray zone, of course, with this. But the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics came out with a statement of recommendations in March of 2013. And their recommendations were to return findings, known and expected pathological findings in 24 diseases which are actionable and for which we could do an intervention or treatment. So this list of findings for return are things like the BRCA mutations for breast cancer, mutations for Lynch syndrome, which is a colon cancer, a variety of other disorders. And they are making the recommendation that we return these results, and I support that return.
So they're recommending that when you're doing whole genome sequencing for another reason, to look for the reason behind a developmental disability, for example, that you also look for mutations in more than 50 genes for these specific 24 conditions that you mentioned, and then that the doctors would then relay that information to the patient.
So I want to kind of have a statement here about how we do this. There's a lot of technology involved with this, and this technology is automated. And so with a lot of this automation, we look no matter what. These variants are being flagged. So it's not that we're specifically looking for them, but these variants are being flagged. And then once these are flagged, what do we do with these variants? Do we continue to look, verify them, and return them to the physician and return them to the patient?
Lainey, I want to bring you into the conversation because I know you have a different viewpoint on this. What do you think about all this?
So first of all, I want to get to the issue of what's an incidental finding. Because actually, if you're looking for intellectual disability, for example, there are parts of the genome you're going to look at. No one's actually going to look at all 3 billion base pairs. And so what the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics has actually suggested is that you're actually going to search these specific areas of the genomes, these 56, even if they're totally not relevant to the reason you're doing the whole genome sequencing. So yes, all 3 billion base pairs may have been sequenced, but that doesn't mean that we were actually trying to analyze it. analyzing. It takes time. It takes resources. It takes somebody trying to figure out this variation is different than what we've seen before. Does that mean it's disease-causing, or is it a variant that we don't even know it's significant, or is it a benign variation? So it's actually not just incidental in the way that you and I might use the term, meaning we actually just happen to pass by it. They're actually mandatorily requiring that healthcare providers search for these in these 56 genes for variants that may be abnormal, that may have a treatment.
And then taking that one step further, do you think that that's a good idea, and should the patients be told about this information?
I want to take it a step back. I think it's a good idea if you want that information, and I think we have to start with the issue of consent. So the way that the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics has written this is that you are mandatorily required to search for it and to report the information back to the doctor, who then we can get into the question of whether the physician should be reporting it back to the patient. But if the patient doesn't want it and the physician doesn't want it, they're still saying you still need to search for it and report this. So it's not just an issue of whether we should be reporting it, but whether we should be reporting it even if individuals don't want it.
Laura, do you agree with sort of the characterization that this is a requirement?
The title of the paper is Recommendations and Guidelines, and it's an area with a lot of controversy. And so the purpose of these guidelines and these recommendations was to try to give us some standard to move forward with. This is a very difficult situation. It's a very difficult area. And so by giving guidelines and standards, it kind of sets a mark for doing something. But there is no part in there where they say, you absolutely must do this. It's the issue of if you deviate from these guidelines, why are you deviating from them? But this is what we would recommend as the standard moving forward.
So we'll agree to disagree on whether it's a requirement, but whether it is or not, Lainey, what are the problems associated with giving this information to patients? I mean, why isn't more information better?
So I want to actually go back one step before I answer that question. We're talking about the March guidelines from the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics. I'd like to mention that I was the lead author on a policy statement by the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics that was co-written with the American Academy of Pediatrics that was published the month prior to these recommendations that we're talking about, which specifically looked at pediatric genetic testing. And one of the things there that we spoke about was, for example, the importance of getting consent prior to doing testing. So one of the problems with reporting back these results, why isn't more information better, is the answer, if I don't want that information. So in general, the American Academy of Pediatric Guidelines, written with the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, said that not really recommended to do testing for adult onset conditions in children. Children, as they become adults, have the right to privacy, even against their parents. Number one, if the information isn't needed for decades, there's no reason to do it now and create undue anxiety. We can do that as you become older with your consent, not with your parents' permission. And in fact, in this case, it's not with anybody's permission. They're being mandated to look for this information.
So other than the potential issue of a parent knowing something about their child, what's the problem with knowing this information? What's the risk?
So the same month that the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics comes out with these 56, what they call pathogenic, meaning very serious conditions and claimed for which we have treatment or preventions, turns out in the European Journal of Human Genetics, an article came out saying some of the genes that we thought were very pathogenic in a heart condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, when we look in the low-risk population, we actually find out that they're not as pathogenic, they're not as severe, they may actually not cause health problems. Some of those genes were part of this, quote, 56, the list from the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics. So that list of 56 was created by looking at high-risk families. When we look in low-risk families, it turns out some of them have those genes and may never go on to develop the health problem. So we're now creating, in a sense, patients in waiting, people who are waiting for, in a sense, you know, the rock to fall, and the rock may never fall. And so we're creating a lot of anxiety. And remember, these are conditions that we're not expecting even to present for decades, when medicine will have evolved a lot, and it might make more sense to wait before we have that information.
Laura?
So I think it's the question of whether the glass is half full or glass is half empty. I think at this point we have a tremendous amount of information about many of these genes. Is it perfect at this point in time? Absolutely not. Are we going to find more information about the new variants that are pathogenic? Absolutely. Are we going to understand that the risk of some of these variants is less? Absolutely. However, the risk for many of these variants is quite high. And with this high risk, the question is, do you want this information or not? So let's give the example of a child. For example, the breast cancer variant, the BRCA mutation. When you have a child in front of you and you identify this variant in the child, you also know that this variant came from one of their parents.
This is a gene that the BRCA mutation that you're talking about, BRCA, it's a gene that would predispose you to developing breast cancer as an adult, obviously.
Yes, breast cancer, ovarian cancer. Angelina Jolie is probably like the famous person having this variant. So now you know that this child has the variant, and you have the information that one of the parents has the variant. And they may not know that they have this variant. So you really kind of ask this question. You have this information. It's true that the child will not develop the disease for a long time, but you have a parent standing there in front of you, and you have information about that parent. And it is this balance about what do you do.
Lainey, do you agree with that, that there's some benefit for the parent to finding out that the child might have a genetic variation like that?
So the answer is maybe. So first of all, the parent may have that genetic mutation, and many people in their family history may have that genetic mutation, and it may never have presented. So we're saying that we're informing you about BRCA. It turns out that in high-risk families, that gene is highly penetrant, and about 80% or 4 out of 5 people who have the gene will go on to develop breast cancer. Turns out in the low-risk population, it's much less. It may be about 1/3 of these individuals will go on. That's still a high risk, but remember, even those of us who don't have BRCA, we have a 1 in 9 chance of getting breast cancer. So we're not changing the risks that much. There's a second question, though. The comment was made, we now know that one of the parents has the BRCA gene. And the answer to that is maybe. We may also be discovering misattributed paternity, that dad isn't the man we thought he was. And again, that's information that the family may not want. So part of this keeps coming back to, if I have to consent to get this information, I can choose whether or not this is information I want and how I will use it. But this is being told that we are going to report this information whether or not the doctor asks for it, whether or not the patient asks for it, and in fact, whether or not they specifically state we do not want this information.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about direct-to-consumer testing, which is basically companies that let someone send in a sample of DNA for sequencing to find out whether or not they might be predisposed to certain diseases. I want to find out how you both feel about that. Let me go to Laura.
Wow, we are really in a time where things are changing dramatically. The genetic technologies are changing quite a bit. So the most famous direct-to-consumer company has been 23andMe, which is this company that did whole genome association studies and then returned results, including results for the BRCA mutations. The controversy behind this is that it is a direct-to-consumer. You've removed the physician genetic counselor intermediary. Several years ago, I was not a believer in this. I was very concerned about the information that was going to be given. And as I've been looking at it more and more, I really see that this is most likely going to be the wave of the future. And why is it going to be the wave of the future? One is an individual could choose to take this test or not. It is their freedom to do this. The second aspect we have of this is that I think the genetic revolution is coming. I think that we all agree that genetics is entering medicine.
But it's getting cheaper and cheaper to do this, right?
Absolutely. The 23andMe, it costs $99. So now we have information in there. And should we give that back to people? Do individuals want it to be given back? And in general, the answer to this has been yes. Over 500,000 people have been tested with 23andMe. There has been the controversy is that they were recently, the FDA made them stop giving the medical conditions and the medical traits, and now they could only give your genetic ancestry. They also identified genetic relatives. So again, mispaternity can be identified with this, but it is the individual's choice. And the other aspect with it is the type of genetic counseling can be given is over the internet. It is a new type information being given. And it's really the question of what do we think about that? That it is scalable, It's large scale. It's tremendous amount of information. And we know we do not have enough genetic counselors at this time to give the face-to-face counseling we've historically given.
So, Lainey, what do we do about this? If this is the future, you know, if it's kind of happening, whether we like it or not, how do we handle this?
So, in a sense, by telling 23andMe that you're only allowed to give ancestry information, what it's basically saying is if you want to learn some recreational information about yourself, go ahead. But when you get into the healthcare world, we have standards. We have evidence-based standards. And so one of the things that we see is somebody like Francis Collins sends three of his samples to three different companies, and in one company he's told he's at increased risk for prostate cancer, and another company he's told he's at decreased risk for prostate cancer.
And Francis Collins is?
The head of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And so why does he get different information? Is one company better than the other? And the answer is he's getting different information because as we keep collecting more and more information, our understanding of the fact that it's not one gene that causes prostate cancer, but there are many genes and how these genes interact. But these genes also interact with the environment. And 23andMe is not collecting environmental information. So their data, they're giving you a very specific increased risk, is totally wrong. I mean, it may be increased, it may be decreased, but until you can combine not just the genetic information with other genetic information, but also with environmental risk, with dietary, with your socioeconomic, with whether your mother was pregnant and drank in pregnancy or was starved during pregnancy, all of these will have health implications for whether you will develop prostate cancer as an older man. And so he proved the problem with trying to give health information through something like 23andMe. I also want to point out that 500,000 is not a very random sample. It's a higher socioeconomic and a higher educated group. And the reason that becomes a problem, in my perspective, is from justice. You can spend your extra $100 however you want, but when you take that $100 and now go to your primary care doc and say, I'm at increased risk, so I want additional testing, and I want to come in more frequently because I need additional surveillance and follow-up, in a sense, you're taking that from everybody. So it's not really $100. It's really a much larger cost to the larger healthcare system, and it's also a cost against those who couldn't afford that first $100, didn't have the health literacy to even know to ask about that first $100 test.
I hear what you're saying, but Laura is saying that sort of, you know, the future of genetics is going to be that it's going to become more accessible, not less accessible. Do you think regulation or these medical boards are going to be able to keep up with, you know, basically keeping us from accessing this information? I mean, it seems like that's not been the way of everything else with social media, and everything is just becoming more accessible, not less so.
Well, I think there are certain parts of medicine that actually are quite regulated. You have a cold and you've decided you need an antibiotic, which is totally inappropriate. You can't get an antibiotic without getting a physician prescription. So in a sense, what the FDA said is we're going to regulate this because if we're giving out health information that can be misused and misunderstood, we need to make sure that we're doing it properly. And part of properly is getting appropriate counseling and putting this information in context. Again, the fact that Francis Collins got higher and lower risk for the same condition is because there wasn't the contextualization that happens in the healthcare provider's office.
I need to go after this because part of it has to do with there's three different levels of genetic variants that 23andMe gives, all these companies give. So there's the Mendelian disorders. You and I think would be in complete agreement about the Mendelian disorders.
I think maybe not. Shaking her
okay,
head. But anyway.
So there's the classic Mendelian disorders. You have one of these variants. The likelihood of you having disease could be extremely high, maybe not 100%, but very high. Sickle cell disease is an example. The BRCA mutations, variants that cause colon cancer, a variety of things. So that testing for those variants is actually quite accurate. Then there's the second group, which is the pharmacogenetic variants, which are variants that affect how you metabolize drugs. We know this for Coumadin, blood thinners, variety of different medications, and then there's complex diseases. So absolutely in the complex diseases, we do not know enough about what's going on. And our group did the same experiment as Francis Collins. We sent a DNA sample from the same individual to three different companies, including 23andMe. So step number one, the genetic variants were identical. When they were tested in the three companies, the exact same genetic variants were reported. So this is the analytic validity. So when you send the sample, it tells you whether you have an A, a G, a T, or a C in that location. There was no discordance with that.
So they're getting the mapping right.
They're getting the mapping right. That mapping is very accurate. Now, the interpretation, in particular with complex diseases, I am in complete agreement, was all over the place. But we're not talking about these complex diseases for the return of results. We're not talking about prostate cancer. We're talking about the BRCA mutations. We're talking about the colon cancer. We're talking about these other diseases. So to bring that in...
Where the research is more solid about the
much,
link.
Much more solid. So there's the example that I want to give about going in and getting a chest x-ray. You go in, you have pneumonia, and you get a chest x-ray. I haven't told you that we could find 100 different things on your chest x-ray. And I've asked the radiologist, I'm getting this chest x-ray for pneumonia. And I find a nodule on your lung, a lesion in your bone. And now, does the radiologist, is it appropriate for them to return that result? Should then the doctor who sees this lesion on your lung tell you this? In general, we've answered that question, said yes. We could find other things, but we should return these results to you. And in general, that's the same strategy that's moving forward here.
Lainey, do you agree that that's a good analogy?
It's an awful analogy because the chest x-ray is in front of you and that's what you see. You see a nodule and, of course, you report it back because it could be life-saving. Here, we have 3 billion base pairs. In order to look in these 56 genes, we're going to have to do additional work. The studies that have published it talked about the number of hours, the number of times they had to go into the literature to look whether this variant was unknown significance, whether it was benign, whether it was serious. And so it took hours and hours of additional work, whereas in this example, we have a radiologist who's looking who sees this because it's part of the same sample. So if you found an abnormality in the same genetic area that you were looking when you were testing, for example, for intellectual disability, that's the analogy. We're not looking in BRCA genes to find intellectual disability, so the analogy fails. But I want to get to the Mendelian genetics and why I was shaking my head no. I'm a pediatrician.
Just to make sure listeners will understand what we're talking about. So when you're talking about Mendelian genetics, you're talking about sort of one gene, one disease. Is that correct?
Yes. That's a beautiful way of describing it. And they can come in two different forms. One is if your parent has the gene and you get that same gene, you're at high risk. And that's autosomal dominant. That's like the BRCA gene that we've been talking about. Another, the sickle cell, each parent is a carrier, so they have one abnormal gene and one normal gene. And when they pass it on, one in four of their children can get both abnormal genes. So that's the Mendelian genetics. And so it sounds like, well, if you get one abnormal gene from each parent, you now have the disease. We're done. So in the newborn screening world, which is an area that's very close to a pediatrician's heart, we've started screening for Krabbe's disease. They've done it in Missouri. They've done it in New York. They're doing it in Illinois. And here we have one disease, one gene. It's an autosomal recessive disease. And when we first started in New York screening for Krabbe's disease, the prediction was that 90% of the children who were found to have a mutation would have an early onset condition, a very severe condition that leads to severe disability and death in childhood. Well, it turns out now that New York's been screening for 5 years, it turns out that 90% that they discover are actually adult onset. And in fact, we're not even sure they'll ever present. But it's not 90% presenting in childhood. It's less than 10% presenting in childhood. So even in the Mendelian, and that's partially because we understand one gene, one disease. What we don't understand is there are modifiers within the genome and there's environmental modifiers. And we don't understand any of this. So we keep giving this very accurate, specific information when really the accurate information is it's ambiguous. We still don't know enough. But we're giving you a very specific 1.5 relative risk compared to other people, and that's just wrong. Even the pharmacogenomics, the Coumadin, there are many different
tests. Reaction to drugs.
The reactions to drugs. The Coumadin is a perfect example where it's still better to just start and keep testing people that all of the – there have been numerous articles showing how all the different tests based on pharmacogenetics have all failed. Again, it's going to get better. But until it gets better, it's research, and people have to consent to research. We don't do it without asking their permission, and when they say no, no is no.
So we could talk about this all day. I'm going to give you each maybe 30 more seconds to kind of make a final point. Go ahead, Laura.
So we're undergoing a genetic revolution, and I see genetics entering medicine. Our goal should be to see how do we have it enter medicine safely, efficiently, effectively. And part of that, I see will be the information is given to individuals. Of course, it's given with their wanting the information, but I see it happening, and I see it direct-to-consumer testing coming.
Okay. 30 seconds, Lainey.
So I hope that genetics is coming. I hope that we're going to improve the education of the primary care doctors as well as the specialists in being able to use the information. But I also realize that it's research at this point, and we need to use the human subjects protections that we use in all research. Genetics is not special, and that includes issues of informed consent and human subjects protections of having research being reviewed by institutional review boards, who also should play a role in deciding what information is ready for prime time and can be disclosed back to patients and research participants.
And our thanks to Veronique LaCapra and Drs. Lainey Ross of the University of Chicago and Laura Byrud of Washington University. Up next, to look at the Missouri legislature at the halfway point, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.